carbon mesh panels, tightens the straps with all the weight of ritual. She sorts through her weapons. Some things cannot be carried openly here, even now in the endgame. A gas gun with shellfish toxin-laced needles will do, she thinks. Turning, Cardoza finds Muesli staring at her. How had he gotten so close? You're on the security subcommittee, he says, his voice shaking. You were spying on the log gang. Right, she tells him. The lie is convenient, he already believes it. This way, she might not have to kill him. She is getting soft. It wasn't nothing but a little dope. Now he is whining. Dope, she thinks. That's not even against the rules around here, unless you're handling weapons or delicate equipment. Look, kid, she says, letting exasperation creep into her voice. She really should kill him. His dead body will cause far less trouble for her than whatever he might say to Zazi or anyone else on one of the subcommittees. Go back to your squad. Lay low and don't come out for a day or so, no matter what. You going after Zazi? Now the fool sounds almost eager. I'm going after you if you don't skid out of here and keep your damn mouth shut. At that, he backs away through the brush which conceals the hollow where the cache is located. I'm sorry, he says from the outside. Me too, kid, Cardoza responds. Her earlier burst of fatalism notwithstanding, she already considers her possible lines of retreat once she has terminated Tiger. Communion. Gloria Barry takes up the hunting knife she uses for emergencies. The blade is longer than her forearm. She has carefully blacked it out, keeping only the edge sharp and bright. Everybody is on high alert suddenly, and she knows damn well why. Tiger has finally betrayed them. She will serve him his own fare, blood warm, and if that fool Anna Chow stands in her way, Gloria will serve her as well. We are disturbed, we of the city. One of the wire mesh dishes strung high in the Douglas firs has picked up a signal, confirming the ghosts which had muttered at the edge of confirmation in the week since Tiger has come to us. Something is on the move. A bombing, a murder, or simple old-fashioned betrayal. It does not matter. Cascadiopolis's years of paranoia are bearing fruit. In another lava tube called Objectivity, the citizens' executive meets in a rare closed emergency session. The man Tiger is not present. It is well into the day, and most of us should have been sleeping long ago. Anyone who has entered the city in the last months, shouts the chair of the labor subcommittee. Manufacturing and Craft shakes her head. We already know where the problem is. That bastard will have us all dancing to his tune in another few weeks. Do you seriously believe Tiger is taking orders from outside? Bashar asks quietly. He doesn't have to, mutters Manufacturing and Crafts. He's plenty dangerous all on his own. Popularity is not danger, Bashar replies. Ever heard of demagoguery? Demands the chair of political education and theory. Bashar cracks a small, deadly smile. Leaders emerge from among the people. We are a collective, the executive chairman says. We don't have leaders. In that moment, Bashar knows they have lost. He rises. Excuse me, but I need to go supervise the security arrangements. Against an airstrike? Demands labor. Against Tiger, if you must know. Bashar shakes his head. And for him, either one. A children's call and response chant, used by early childhood facilitators in Cascadiopolis. Why are we green? Because nature is green. Why do we hide in the hills? Because nature lives in the hills. Who do we trust? Ourselves and nature. Who do we fear? Everyone outside. What will we do? Grow and grow like nature. Until when? Until the world is green. Tiger heads back to the kitchen where he cooked the first night. It is time to cook again. Wine at the wedding, catfish and cornbread for the crowd, blood beneath the plowboards. Food is the oldest sacrament. He has been here long enough to know more about the ingredients. Wood ears grown in the deadfalls on these slopes can be as rich as steak. Wild onions and sweet herbs from the water meadows provide a flavor which speaks of these high places. Saps boiled to bitter syrups add a tinge. So he makes a stew, humming the doxology. Different words are in his mind now than the old hymnals would have it, about the quiet green cathedrals of these high slopes and the basalt bones buried in the loam beneath his feet. Tiger is not sure whether he will share them. The stew comes along slowly and he hums. Cooking by daylight is not so common. Smoke can escape sometimes, and most people shift their meals in the early evening and later night hours to be well abed by dawn. But he knows a strike is coming. Probably not the orbital kinetics which reduce Jack City to ash, though that is possible. Even the oldest schools, the most ancient secret keepers, have some very modern codes, and their own quiet, bloody disputes. Except he is not weapon, but target. The hurried busyness around him confirms that. It might have gone differently, lasted longer, been sweeter. But this is of no mind to Tiger now. One way or another, these forests will burn bright, even if no match is ever set. Like those pines which only germinate amid flame, this city will not truly spread its seed until the threat is overwhelming. The dandelion flower must die before its children can fly. With that thought, he smiles and cuts the dried trillium into his stew. "Was it you?" Bashar asks. Close behind, silent. The man is an arrow fired in the dark. "It was always me," Tiger says pleasantly without turning. He can smell the musk of Bashar's desire for him that the other man will never admit. Bashar barely acknowledges women, finds men no fit object whatsoever for lust, but the scent will not be denied. "But I did not breach communication security, if that is your question." "Could you have?" Bashar sounds fascinated. Tiger slices thin strips of garter snake jerky, then scrapes them into his pot. This will be a stew of the high places. After that, he faces Bashar. "Couldn't any of us?" Tiger's clicker has been heel-smashed to black sand in the stream bed these past 3 weeks. That city man's contract had its uses in getting him close. Passage through certain difficult barriers, but had never been his true purpose. "You're in trouble," Bashar says. "With you?" Tiger cocks an eyebrow. "With everyone, I think. The citizens' executive is stirred up. There are other rumors, people with difficulties." "Everybody loves me," he grins at Bashar's stone face. "Well, almost everybody. Everybody is coming for you. Jack City scared us all." "Jack City is dead," Tiger says. He ladles out a bowl of stew. "It would be better if it sat up for a shift or two. We don't have that much time." Handing the bowl to Bashar, he continues, "Here, take, eat and be comforted. Jack City is dead, but Cascadiopolis is going to live forever." Bashar plucks a spoon from the tabletop and eats. Everything he does around this man is wrong. He knows it. The flavor stops his thoughts. It tastes of the city, of Mount Hood, of all the vanishing green in the world. High slopes and deep loam and the bugling of elk across the valleys. Glacier melt and the buzzing silences of the burn scars in summer. He is consumed by a moment of transcendence, and in that moment sees the future. "There is a woman with a gun. Another woman carries a knife with dire intent. A committee votes orders for their man Bashar to carry out. A satellite rotated on its axis, acquiring a target in the Cascades. Children run through the bear grass, shrieking at the flowers. City-building manuals are stored in quantum matrices embedded in small river cobbles that fit in the palm of a hand. Silences amid the high forests remember times before even the First Nations had passed here on calloused feet. The world is running down, but it will always be reborn. Coastlines retreat, and there are new beaches. Flood waters recede, and there is a dove on a drenched olive branch. Empires fall, but people still break the ground for grain. And their grandchildren need to keep records, and so it begins again. Capital, rebellion, chaos, climate change. It all comes together so it can all be pulled apart once again. We wonder if it matters how he died. The city kill will come soon enough. This day, next season, 10 years down the road, there is no real difference. Tiger's stew, his song, his folding of the place of the green city into a simple taste in a few words. These are the winds that will scatter the seeds. Different mountains, different meadows, estuaries that have never seen a volcano piercing the sky. It does not matter. The city will be born and reborn again until stamping it out will be like stamping out worms after a rainstorm. And this time, capital and rebellion and ancient scholarship have combined to ensure the future restarts without having to repeat every lesson of the past. We crossed a threshold, shed our big science and big industry in favor of little things which could be carried in a pocket and last a generation. Ideas, ideals, and no small measure of love in a cruel and dying world. Bashar sits with Anna Chow as she carves the marker. Such delicate work is not truly suited to her style of shaping stone. She is better at ashlars and slabs. Still, someone must do this thing, and by daylight, for it is too delicate to be worked in the shadows. Though Anna carves a flame, the city is not burned yet. People are leaving anyway, not in a rush seeking refuge, but in twos and tens and scores. The secret societies of couples and the tribalism of work gangs. They all carry stones, and each stone is filled with data. Most carry tools as well, enough simple wedges and hammers and crucibles to jumpstart the first year of effort in some other wild place. The grave contains three bodies. Tiger lies in the embrace of two women who did not know one another. The blood is on Bashar's hands in the end. That is who he is. That is what he does, killing the only man he will ever love, and striking down the enraged assassins in the moments which follow. His days are shortened, too. The darts which ripped into his arm have left him with a paralysis which will be fatal in his line of work. Bashar does not mind so much. He just wants to see things set to rights before he walks off on his own. "I may be some time," will be his epitaph, borrowed from half-remembered history, but still true enough. A stranger approaches through the woods, a man clearly not accustomed to running down roads. Bashar meets the newcomer's gaze, an old but serviceable pistol ready in his still good left hand. "You won't need that," says William Silas Crown. "I just wanted to come see for myself." He nods at the grave. Bashar knows there is no point in asking how. Tiger's flame was all too visible far from the night-dark forests of Cascadiopolis. He does have one question, though.
"Did you send him?"
Bashar asks Crown.
"I thought I did," Crown answers slowly. "But we were used alike, you and I."
Bashar, Anne, and Crown stay by the grave till evening, watching the satellites transit the sky. One flares, possibly turning into the sun, possibly launching kinetics at some grounded target. It would be nice to say that Tiger arrived in Cascadiopolis on the wings of a storm. He did not, for he came as a man. But he left with everyone who walked away before the end, his power multiplied by his name on all their lips. His stone yet remains, if you know where to look, blackened by ash, covered by creepers, silent and cold as the mountain itself.
During the world-building discussions the Metatropolis authors had, I remember Tobias Bakel being very passionate about the idea of building some of our future cities not on some new piece of land, but in the very heart of existing cities. In Toby's specific case, he was fixated on Detroit. This made interesting sense to me, since Toby lives not too far from the Motor City and travels there frequently. He's had ample opportunities to see this city up close. But beyond that, I think Toby was also interested in making sure that the cities of the future also looked like and had connection with the cities of the present. In other words, that the people of our metropolis didn't just look like suburbanites wearing tunics or something similarly ridiculous. And so, Toby's Detroit is a city that feels like the urban cities of today, populated with the people who live there now and will be there when the future arrives, however it comes. It's also a place where just a little bit of cooperation, in its many different forms, makes the city move. But now I'm going to leave that to you to discover. Here's Tobias Bakel and Stochasta City, read by Scott Brick.
The day before the city rioted was a day for me like any other. The day before Maggie pulled me deep into the shit. I was up late that night, bouncing at Zaza's, just barely covering my bus pass for the month. Same shit, different day. I had this funny feeling that I'd be moving on soon, which I did every couple years, as a shrimp of man stared up at me and asked, "What are you looking at?" And I thought, there had to be somewhere more interesting to be than Detroit. I'd gotten into a rut here. The shrimp pushed at me, spoiling for a fight. I found that the trick to bouncing, just as much as standing around and looking perpetually annoyed, was negotiation. Not negotiation as in the "I'm gonna give you something for something you agree to do for me" kind, but the sort of negotiation where you agree not to stave in some drunk bastard's skull in exchange for his leaving the club. And although that doesn't sound like negotiation, with a drunk it really is. Because it takes a lot of circuitous explanation, leading, and alternate phrasing to make them realize they're in for a load of shit. Stop breaking the pool cues. I used a calm, patient tone. It was, after all, a calm and reasonable request. Even if it wasn't a request, really. What are you going to do about it? Even with all the negotiation, however, you also end up negotiating how much shit they might be in. It was a Monday night. Usually a slow night. No jumping DJ using their antique original iPods lacquered in sparkling silver to run the floor. No girls' night. No happy hour. No nothing. Just the regulars, quietly slinking their way towards an easier form of despair, hunched over the hump of the stained wood surface at the bar. Huddled against each other, backs turned to the expanse of the empty, unlit dance floor. Just the core regulars and this belligerent asshole who was up in my face. "What are you gonna do about it?" he repeated. He must have thought he wasn't 3 inches shorter than me, or that he wasn't 50 pounds lighter. This little one had something to prove. Screw it. I grabbed the yappy guy's hand before he even realized it and twisted him around in front of me. He struggled a bit, so I half-Nelsoned him quick, then marched him right past the bar. Several customers turned to watch, beers raised in a mocking half-salute as I gently shoved the shrimp out the doors. He tried to turn around and come back in, so I sucker-punched him. As he sagged to the dirty concrete, I grabbed his collar and threw him against the brick facade of the club, the Zaza's neon sign blinking and fitzing in front of us. Both of us looked eerie orange, then green. "Come back in. I break something," I said, and left him there with one more good shove. Back inside the gloom, the new bartender, Maggie, looked up from setting a beer mug down in front of an old man with a long white beard. "Want me to call the Eddies?" She was probably too young to be pulling bar duty, but she was good at listening to wasted customers. She was also pretty enough to pull the extra tips she needed, and surprisingly tough. The electrified deterrent clothes she wore were remarkably effective, too. I'd seen patrons writhing on the floor after a butt pinch. Now they kept clear of her like cows from an electric fence. "Nah," I leaned against the bar on my elbows. "If he's got an issue with me now, imagine what it'll be like when he wakes up with a bill after spending a night in the drunk tank. Last thing he needs is a lien on his house or something stupid. Call a cab. And where the hell is Lawrence?" "Still running late." Maggie tapped the phone in her ear. I noticed she had a bit of a bruise under her right eye, covered with makeup. I wondered what from. Asshole boyfriend? Did she like her men wild and dangerous? It was certainly none of my business. She cocked her head. "Want me to call him again?" "Forget it. I'd have to sleep in the storage room until morning. The last bus would be leaving downtown Detroit any second. I'll hit the cot tonight. Besides, it'd save me some money. Whoever the pipsqueak drunk was, he was lucky. He was a downtowner, could get home on a cab without spending a good portion of his day's wages. He could afford to get drunk. That's three times this week. Go take a nap when Lawrence gets here. I'll drop you off." "Maggie." "Reg, I insist." No one called me Reg. Except her. I'm Reginald. Reginald Stratton. But she could get away with Reg. It was the cheerfulness, I guessed. Maggie let her car drive us there with a cheerful abandon, setting the vehicle's profile to aggressive and letting it weave in and out of traffic as it wind its way on. From the somewhat revised downtown, then on past the decaying warehouses and skyscrapers of the heydays, and from there into the sudden change of the nice suburbs, the ones within a short, very short driving distance. I didn't live there, though. I lived in the decay of the wilds. The further out you got, the longer it took to drive, the more gas it cost, out where battery cars like Maggie's and bikes couldn't easily get to, the rougher it got. And that's where I lived. It began with the abandoned tract houses, many just slumped over, windows shattered, roofs failed or riddled with pigeons and shit. I grew up somewhere like this, a dead end an hour and a half away from any major urban center. A safe place, a protected space to raise your little ones. Or so we thought back then. All the while burning your way via car to and fro work. Back then. Now those artificial greens and wooden houses were abandoned for the most part, given away for the land to reclaim as its own. At the very edge of the wilds, I had Maggie pull over into the driveway. I pulled out 100, but she shook her head. "Let's take a look." She followed me in. I wasn't sure what this was about, but then Maggie was the only one who got to call me Reg. "Welcome to Casa Stratton." I waved my hand at the 3 acres of vegetable gardens and a large greenhouse I'd built out of windows reclaimed from houses further into the wilds. "It's a fucking mansion," Maggie declared. "House belonged to some formerly rich family once upon a time. All the stone and brickwork stopped it from getting burned up for steam engines or winter heating."
"And you own it?"
I shook my head. "Course not. No one owned them. That would have meant paying taxes. These were abandoned, but couldn't be purchased because no one would claim them, as that would result in having to owe back taxes, with interest, for decades. All these buildings floated in limbo, just like the outer skyscrapers. The slumps. Perfectly good real estate, abandoned and not truly owned by anyone, and thus unable to be renovated. I knew a lot of people who'd give their right nut to live in the close-by skyscrapers. Instead, they were guarded by private security, or even on contract by Edgewater. Those owners kept them from being reclaimed, but you couldn't trace who those owners were. They were waiting for the good times to come back. Who wouldn't kill to live closer to the urban hub? Let the megacorp farms deliver food into where you all were easily gathered? No more gardening for myself, no more hour-long commutes, and most of my months take going into transportation costs. Looks nice, though, Maggie said. You got an extra room, I'll move in. But don't get excited. This is simple business. Leaving him? Maggie looked confused, then touched the bruise under her eye and laughed. You think it's a guy? No, it was a lot of guys. Eddies. What did you do to piss the Eddies off? Hiding out up in a penthouse in the slumps. They found me. Ah. So you want to couch surf me? In exchange for half the cost of your bus pass. My car is cheap to run. She charged up the car at work, some sort of agreement with the owners. Plus, buses are getting less and less regular. Could all quit soon enough. Having my transportation costs. Sounded harmless enough. I agreed and showed her a spare room. There were seven. No real trouble other than having a pretty roommate who was entirely uninterested in me. Welcome to poverty homesteading, I thought. But it beat getting flushed out of the city by Edgewater. I'd made the same mistake Maggie had when I first arrived downtown, seeing an empty skyscraper as an opportunity. Fortunately, I'd had enough on me to pay the Edgewater holding fee and get loose. Every once in a while, I wondered what happened to the homeless the Eddies rounded up who couldn't pay. Later in the night, once Maggie was fast out asleep, I padded out into the backyard and off into the wilds. Survival training-wise, that is, flitting my way through forest and suburban ruins. My bolt hole was about 2 miles from my house, next to an old oak tree. Buried near a massive root, I had my whole stake in a lockbox. Sure, currency could devalue, but that hit everyone equally. With cash in hand and hidden, no hacker, frauder, lawyer, Edgewater flunky, or government could get at my savings. Good luck finding this out in the wilds. Maggie, on the way in the next morning, talked about the various cities she'd bartendered her way through. Living out of the back of her car, charging up and moving on. She'd seen the East Coast, she told me. Now she was moving on through the Midwest, although she wasn't sure how the car would do in open spaces. She was thinking about saving up for an ox, or maybe a donkey, to pull it when power ran out, or when she couldn't get gas to fill the generator in the back of the car. Driving by day, sleeping under the stars, seeing something new every day. I don't want to ever give it up, she said. I lay slumped against the passenger window in my usual morning stupor, watching the dirty sidewalk slip past. A lot of trash was building up. Every other week, pickups. But there was something new. Something I should have noticed on the bus rides in, but was too busy balancing in the aisle to see out the window and notice. The bouncy roads kept you busy hanging on if you didn't get a seat. People milled around the sidewalks. I would have said they were homeless, but they didn't look like garden variety homeless. They were all clean-shaven, well-clothed. A variety of hairstyles, punk to stiff to endovers. A lot of them wore gray suits, others a loose poncho. They all sat along the street watching traffic and life pass by. Some waved as we passed them by. One of them sat next to a large plastic cube that was folding itself up, deflating from where it was hooked to the side of the street. Some sort of mobile tent. Most of them bunched up near the disused skyscrapers of the outer ring. As we hit downtown, they thinned out. But we passed one last pair sitting on folding chairs, fruit drinks in hand with little umbrellas perched off to the side. Listen, Maggie said. You still hurting for cash? Yeah. Two men in blue pinstripes leaned against a corner, talking into earpieces. I'd done a tour. These guys were doing recon. I'd have bet the day's tips on it. What the hell was going on out in the slumps? I needed to pay more attention to the news, because whatever it was, the Yetis would be onto it soon. If there was going to be any trouble anywhere downtown, I wanted to know about it before it reached me. I wasn't just trying to sleep out there last night for no reason. There's a guy paid me a week's worth to try and shelter in the slums for a night, Maggie said. I'd run out. Couldn't afford the hotel I was in anymore. Creepy? Turk work. Anonymous. Some piece of software is my second boss. I found the job on a list. Looking for people in Detroit to do stuff around the city. Random shit. Day one, I delivered a package lying out on a counter in a hotel to a bike courier 10 blocks away. Then a couple days later, I had to walk up to the top of some old car park and toss some paper balls over the side. Weird stuff. Random. Paid well. Last night, it was good pay to see how long I could stay in a slump building. Some other guy, a lawyer, turking out himself, probably, came and bailed me out from the Yetis. As promised, if I got caught. Job listing still up? I asked. Nah. But whoever's running this is offering me a bonus to refer people verbally. Maggie handed me a piece of paper with an email address or random numbers on it. One-time encryption, no doubt. A week's worth. Pay like this. And with the money Maggie was saving me, I might be able to think about a place in the city. I could ditch the house in the wilds after Maggie inevitably moved on. Week, she confirmed. That's worth a bruised eye, I said. Damn straight. Plus, it sounded harmless enough. I don't know why it's called turking. Taking a complicated task and putting it up online, divvying up the parts of a task between multiple people and paying for the results. That had been going on a long time. Say you needed someone to find a certain face in a crowd if you were an Edgewater investigator. You could upload the photo of the perp you were hunting, and then upload pictures of crowds you suspected the person was in. Then you put the task up online and paid whoever turned in a result. Saved you time. Someone else did the idiot work, and you got to focus on higher-level stuff. But it went further than that. Suppose you had a package in Los Angeles that needed to get to New York. When I was a kid, you'd go to a centralized post office, pay for stamps, and it would be taken on a special van at a certain time of day along a series of routes to an airplane, across the country with a bunch of other packages to a distribution center, and then on to more vans to finally end up in New York. And most of all that was run by that one company. Today, you turked the package out, left it at a street corner with a price embedded on the package's tag. Someone going in the right direction would snag it and get the credit or partial credit for taking it as close to the goal as they could get it. But other things were also turked out. Insidious things. And you'd never know. All you were being asked to do was walk a package a couple miles from one place to another. What was in the package? None of your business. And if you opened it, the tag could snag a picture of you or pass on the information you used to agree to grab the package with to the owner. No sense doing that. So there was also no sense in wondering what I was complicit in when I pinged the email on the piece of paper Maggie'd given me and got back a set of simple instructions. I was to stand on the corner not too far from an Edgewater depot, and when they left their compound, text a certain number. Simple enough. And with good pay. I'd make what I made in 3 or 4 nights bartending to do this. Someone really wanted to know what Edgewater's comings and goings were. Not really harmless anymore, but still potentially lucrative. I left work early for my street Turk assignment, walking my way over to the location. I stood in the hot night, wind kicking faded pieces of litter past me. Dirt kicked up, grit stinging my eyes, and the nighttime rush of the city flowed by. I had staked out a spot on the street near an alley where part of a brick wall collapsed in. No one could walk up behind me, and I had the shadows to lurk in. Trails of brake lights burned on the back of my retinas as cars whined past. Some even thundered past. Uncollected trash out on the sidewalk smelled rich, making the thermos of coffee I had clipped to my belt seem unappetizing. The Edgewater compound broke into a flurry of activity as a large armored van full of men in riot gear rolled on out, a siren burping out a staccato series of wails and screeches. I texted. Over the next 8 hours, I texted 3 more times as the streets fell into their late-night rhythm of random cars, distant sirens, and the occasional catfight that broke out near any given garbage can. Simple enough. When dawn broke over the skyline, I had an hour left. I was that much closer to leaving the wilds. And it was then I heard the click of a safety catch being released in the alley behind me. Impossible, but there it was. I had the lid cup of the thermos filled with coffee. I slowly raised both hands, the thermos cup lid hanging off my pinky. The eddies must have spotted me. "On the ground," spat the voice behind me. I followed the order. Once I kissed the sidewalk, he zip-tied my hands behind me. I heard an engine gun up loudly as a vehicle whipped around the street corner. I was wrenched up to standing and tossed into the back of the armored personnel carrier that I had watched roar out of their compound all night. In the dim light inside, they shoved me up against a metal bench. 5 men in full urban combat garb stared at me. With gray fatigues and night vision goggles, they were also fully kitted out to climb buildings, blow out doors, and rush in with a shoot-first-ask-questions-later sort of look to them. "Good morning," said the nearest Eddie. "What have we here?" "He was staking us out," said the one who'd snuck up on me. After Sudan, I'd been offered a job as an Eddie in Cleveland. By then, I'd put in enough time kicking down doors and trying to figure out if the gray-green blob inside my night vision goggles was going to shoot me or run screaming. "You staking us out, you little concrete bunny?" The nearest Eddie, a pale-looking thin dude with a sour smell, leaned in. "You related to those fuckers that have been setting off little bombs and running for it, just to get us to run around all night? You getting off on wasting our time?" Nothing I said would be helpful, but if I remained quiet, that was a problem, too. They had me here in the armored carrier because they could rough me up some before getting back to the compound. They were having a long night, and now they had a target. Straight truth was the easiest course. No running around. "I'm not sure what you're talking about," I said. "But maybe. I got paid a good bit. Street turking, just to stand there and text a number if you guys ran out in a hurry. I bartend at Zaza's usually, but I'm out in the wilds. They offered me good money to stand here. Bus fares are tight, you know the drill." The nearby Eddie still looked keyed up to cause me some pain, but the Eddie standing in silhouette at the entrance to the carrier nodded. "Makes sense. Turk out the stakeout, just like the guy last night. We'll bust you, they'll have a turked-out lawyer ready and waiting. They have other Turks watching this scene, if last night was any indication." "Fuckers," the sour-smelling Eddie said. "Take this joker to a cell and wait for bail. Charge the max for loitering," the Eddie outside said. He sounded in charge and on top. "Might as well see some good green for our trouble." "Shit." Sour-smelling Eddie spat something nasty and brown at my feet.
"Sure about that?"
"Dee and me will take patrol, see if we can flush out the other Turks." This Eddie looked young and tired. He rubbed his face. Maybe he'd commanded a squad overseas, enough savvy to get noticed and promoted to running things when he got back. Now he probably sensed something was in the air, something that didn't bode well for the Eddies. Outside, Eddie shut the doors and slapped them, and the carrier lurched into gear. Sour-smelling Eddie smiled at me. I didn't like him. Some people enjoyed their jobs way too much. This punk was probably some kid from the Midwest, one of those who seemed to think that everyone non-white was to blame for everything that was wrong with the country since any of the various crises it hit. He took some relish in policing the city, putting certain people in their place. Probably had a no-immigration bumper sticker on his electric pickup cart. Even though it was mostly Canada and the Europeans trying to keep us contained in our own borders these days. And followed me in. I turned to face him. Can I help? He hit me hard in the stomach, but I'd already tensed and let my torso move with the blow. Still hurt. All this bus riding and gardening didn't exactly keep me in peak shape. I needed to remember to work a bit harder on that. I was a bouncer after all. Back a few steps, I was ready for the next, but someone smacked the windows with the palm of their hand. Hey, Gary, knock that shit out. The community management officer of the station stood outside. CMO S. Watton, the patch on his chest indicated. Unlike all the other head-shaved urban commandos I'd run into tonight, Watton had a business cut going. Middle management kind of look. A suit. But you could see in his posture that he was command through and through. Probably served in the same fields as me. Been given a pat on the back, a gas bonus, and taken private work on his return. S. Watton shook his head. Gary, you lose your cut. What? Gary looked genuinely shocked. I helped pull this one in. He's got a lawyer outside. If you kept going, they wouldn't be paying us permanent bail, idiot. They'd be getting a force and violence payout from us. Watton shoved Gary back. Keep it up, Gary. Keep it up, and I'll happily toss your ass out of the dorm and let you walk to work every day. See how long you last on your own 2 feet. A known Edgewater walking out and around. He'd get knifed in the back before long unless he was very quick on his toes. Gary didn't strike me as quick on his toes. Gary swallowed, and with a glance back at me, left the room. But this wasn't over. CMO S. Watton stood in the middle of the door, looking me over. You don't have any property to post a lien against. Got a lawyer outside. Got no money our computer can find. But no record. They couldn't find my money because I took it out and buried it deep in the wilds, in the backyard's woods. You gonna knock me around and tell me to keep more pocket change on me so that next time you won't feel like you wasted your effort? No, Watton sighed. Not going to waste the effort. Not going to drill through a thick grunt's skull like yours. I chuckled. Yeah, plus I don't take orders anymore. Fair enough. But Watton still hadn't moved. You don't know what the hell you were doing out there. You know how it works, I said. This was leading to something else, though. I've seen enough turked out armies in my time, Watton said. I look young, but I paid out hard. I've seen the ghosts merging in on you. Kids with fireworks, others with guns, others with cameras waiting for you to make the inevitable mistake. Watton said ghosts, and he looked haunted. His wide eyes flicked back to memories of battles past. The warlords would hand out cell phones like candy to the kids. Promise them gas or food to carry out errands. And individually, not much was going on. But as a whole, a vast and complicated and decentralized attack, they could bring armies down to their knees before anyone knew what had happened. I could see Watton opening fire on some starving teenager with a toy gun, while the cameras relayed the horrible results live to some hungry waiting news service. Then after the cameras shut off, the kids with the real guns, who looked just like the others, moved in to attack. You know something big is moving, Watton said. People staking us out. Street turkers all over the place setting up things. Waiting. Out there. You know what the revised articles of engagement are, Reginald? Yeah, I know them. It's why I wouldn't ever become a damned Eddie, or any domestic boot-stomping Yahoo. All you did for a Turked army was to put a brick down by the side of a road, and maybe all it took was a few hundred other bricks placed to create a roadblock. Individually, you could claim you were just making a buck, but that still made you an enemy combatant, which meant you were no longer a citizen. You didn't belong to another country, either. There were no rules about what they could do to you then. You simply didn't exist as far as the rule of law was concerned. At some point, Wotton told me, us Eddies will get attacked here. And we don't stay Eddies when it turns into a war. When the Nationals get mobilized, we're a subdivision of the army. Then people like Gary and the real commandos, they'll come in shooting, kicking in your teeth and really showing you some pain. I shrugged. You know of another way I can cover my transportation? Some place to stay here in town? Wotton crossed his arms over his chest. So for that, you're dumb enough to work for some Turker you don't even know? The people you're Turking for don't even have reputation points. You have no idea what the big scheme is? I've seen you around down at Zaza's. You're no tool. Hierarchy of needs, CMO. Give the indigenous infrastructure. They don't have to depend on desperate moves. That was a barb that dug deep. Wotton had commanded. No doubt he'd heard that phrase often enough. He'd have taught it, too. Get dropped into some third world situation where they had nothing. No matter the reason, you soon found out that whoever hated your ass could drum up eager waves of hungry soldiers throwing themselves against you. There was always some rhetoric. But when you dug deep, it always came down to the simple fact that the ready to die simply had nothing to lose. They'd sign up and take the math. If enough of them attacked, maybe they'd live. Maybe they'd get something out of it. Save their family. Get something to eat, live, whatever. Now give them something to lose, then those waves thinned out. Infrastructure, running water, food, medical assistance, homes, roads and travel. The most devastating tools of war. But in a world where even the first world nations struggled to provide transportation, water and safety, well, domestic shitstorms started to look like foreign ones. What you never thought you'd see anywhere but abroad, that came home with you. Whether the starving and displaced were in Africa, or sitting around a dike that had burst somewhere on a coast here, the pressures were the same. Particularly once the domestic dike had been broken over and over again, where citizens realized that it wasn't just a one-off. Weather had changed, and the government didn't have much to help them with. That's when your thin line of civilization faded. Welcome home, Wotton. And by the way, you never left the front line, I think to myself. He got it. He stepped aside to let me walk past and down the corridor. At the other end, a gray-suited man with a briefcase waited for me. My mysterious lawyer and fellow Turker. I was pushing up a good defense for one. The truth was, I was getting nervous. I didn't know what the hell I was getting myself into. And maybe it was time to get myself out. The lawyer asked me to keep my mouth shut until well clear of the compound. Sign this, initial here, don't worry about that. Quick, assured, and efficient. I was buzzed through the thick bomb-proof doors in no time. He had a bike outside, an old and well-traveled carbon fiber Schwinn with a GPS in the handle and a heavy saddle on the back. He wheeled it alongside me. Your fine has been covered. Your night's work is done, he said. Thank you. I'd checked my account on my phone, but didn't see the rest of my night's pay. I mentioned it. The lawyer looked over at me and sighed. It's in the fine print. The cost of springing you is far more than your payoff, so you get nothing as a result of getting arrested by this Edgewater franchise. You're getting a good deal, trust me. I never took too well to getting pissed on and being told to like it. I'm not a fine print kind of man. Had they paid me after a successful mission where the Eddies wouldn't have had anything to take from me, I would have been up for the night. Now all I had to show for the night's efforts was the down payment on this little affair and some very sore ribs. But the contract remains what it is, Mr. Stratton. Can't wriggle out of these things, you know. I licked my lips. I'm pretty good at not getting noticed. How'd they spot me to round me up? The lawyer mounted his bike. I don't know, Mr. Stratton. Like you, I was just called in to take care of this. I'm just a Turker, making some side money. He picked up speed, pulling away from me. You know how it works. I don't know who you are or what you were doing. None of my business. I was just here to pay your fine and get you on your way. He left me there on the quiet, run-down streets. I flipped through my phone's address book and emailed the Turker email address I'd gotten the job through, but it bounced back. Annoyed, I started a quick jog after the lawyer, sucking air shallowly thanks to the bruised ribs. The money was a magnet, dangling just out of reach. Turker or not, someone was going to pay me the other damn half of what I was owed. 3 miles later, second thoughts occurred as I clutched my ribs, struggling to keep up with the lawyer's leisurely pace. In the early morning dawn, peeking over sullied and coal-stained brick, I realized more and more people were filling the streets I was huffing my way through. Again, an odd and silent community of well-off homeless standing near their collapsible mobile structures. I smelled eggs and sausage sizzling. My mouth both watered and my stomach twisted at the smell of food. Not a good sign after all the jogging. The great old Ambassador Bridge loomed over the buildings, the gaping bombed ruins of the roadway overhead thrumming in the wind. Thank you, Canadian Air Force, for that one. I turned a corner and into a scene that for a moment didn't make any sense. The parking lots and gardens of this area were overrun with massive tents, large RV-type vehicles with masts, lean-looking roadboats, and tens of thousands of people. Some sort of instant Midwest Burning Man festival, it seemed. The lawyer disappeared into the center of the mass of people, and 3 very burly bikers stepped forward. Dark shades already on in the morning sun, their leather jackets festooned with tiny tags and symbols. "Where's your ID?" the first asked, long beard whipping about as a dust devil passed by, fluttering tent flaps and flags on poles all around. Roadboat rigging twanged a chorus. "I must have left it somewhere," I said, calmly walking toward them, trying to eyeball where the lawyer disappeared. "Nice try. You can't." The nearest biker body-checked me away. Fucking footprinter. My ribs flared pain hard enough to make me suck air in through my teeth. "Listen," I held my hands up. That made it hurt more. "I'm not trying to cause any trouble, but I need to talk to someone. You got trouble understanding?" The biker's tone was familiar. The sort of negotiating tone used to indicate he'd agree not to stave in my skull if I agreed to leave the camp. I backed away. "Get out, footprinter. Get out now." I turned around, wincing. Back to the bar, then. Only this time I called for a cab. But things didn't exactly get any better there. Lawrence sat on a chair inside the door, but a big closed sign he'd hand-lettered had been hung on the door. "What the hell's going on?" I asked. "Maggie went home. No bartender, no bar." I blinked. She had no reason to be home. It made no sense. What could she be up to? My stomach twisted. I still had a bus pass. I ran like hell in time to make the morning bus out to the wilds. Maggie's car wasn't at the house when I got there. And the lockbox, 2 miles out in the depth of the wilds, wasn't there either. I sat next to the empty dirt hole, my back against the root, and flung an acorn out into the bush. Cute little Maggie, the bartender too wispy to be in a brutal downtown. She was a nomad, stringing her way through the brutal and lawless wilds of the continent. Maggie was probably tougher than me, certainly smarter. My savings had just been wiped out, and she probably had enough to make the next leg of her journeys. It rained most of the way back, a dirty, whipping, Detroit grimy sort of rain. I watched the remains of it congeal on the outside of the bus's windows as I was jerked back and forth between the quiet mass of commuters making their way in. I recognized one of the guys several seats ahead of me, one of the squatters in the wilds who'd given me advice on my garden. He had dog tags hanging off a necklace, something a lot of the reclamation groups off in the wilds had. Little kudos for each other, signs that told each other where they stood in their own subworlds. They would be happy to welcome me into their little tribe, I had no doubt. I could teach self-defense in one of their creches, sleep on recycled packing foam beds, help out in their gardens. But I'd done the farmer boy routine. I'd joined the army to leave that. Not my talent, I'd found. I'd found my talent the day 7 nomads descended on the farm I was working at. I blinked at the dirty rain. Hadn't thought about that in too many years. The crack of a gun. The screams of wounded. All too easy. Shooting people, that was. Easier than deer, mostly. But it left you odd, somehow. A little less human each time, but with the knowledge that you could do it if it came to it. I thought about standing in front of the bar. Thought about all the work put into the brick house. Thought about each bill taken home, buried near the tree. Maggie pulled one over on me, and I didn't hate her for it. Not a bit. I hated myself for falling into a routine, a sense of complacency and tired resignation. Miasma of life that had made it so easy for her to do this to me. Things didn't come to people who waited, who picked over the trash and hoped to find treasure. It came to those who grasped. But then I wondered if that was the same attitude that had led the world to burning up its resources and leaving the dregs for us. Lot of maybes and buzzing going around and around in the back of my head. I quashed it all. I'd made a decision. I wanted my damn money. After that, I'd figure out what I was taking into my own hands next. I walked to the Edgewater compound and pounded on the gates until a dubious S. Watton ambled out to regard me through the chicken-wired bars. "What the hell do you want, Stratton?" "The lawyer. Who was he?" Watton's pitying look dripped scorn. "Come on, Stratton. We don't know the lawyer's name. And don't play like you've never encountered one and don't know the routine." I did know the routine. Since the Lawyer Protection Act, lawyers used public encryption keys, not names, to protect their identities. Too many of them found hanging from lampposts by their necks. His key. Give me his key. It could have been someone turked to represent the lawyer in real time, with an earpiece directing him what to say and when, or an apprentice lawyer turked out, or maybe the real lawyer. Hard to tell these days. Risky profession. "Expired. Stratton, what are you doing?" "They owe me money. I want paid. I've seen him out by the bridge, hiding among some homeless camp. Who paid for my fine? Maybe you know that. They had to have something." Watton moved closer to the chicken wire. He didn't touch it. Electrified. "You really want the lawyer that bad?" I folded my arms and nodded. "Okay," Watton said. "We want him too. We want to know what the hell is going on. You get in there. You find him out, or anything out. We'll straight up pay you for the info." They were that fucking desperate for any tidbit of info. Hiding here in their sandbagged fort. I felt a shiver move up my back. "I just want them to pay me up. Anything I find out, I'll pass on." Watton bobbed his head a bit, considering whether to trust me. That little cloud of desperation hung over him. He buckled. "I'll give you a car rental, chit. Straight cash bonus." He named a price. Good price. These kids were scared. I took it. What do you know? You're fine. It was paid by Spaceship Detroit, a non-profit. Sounded odd. Who the hell are they? Watton didn't know. What do they do? Watton, again, didn't know. But it was something. I turned my back on him. Spaceship Detroit. They'd pay up. Or give me another job. I'd get roughed up for big money. But mainly I could sense it out there. Something moving through the city. Something big. And I wanted to rip a piece of it off for myself. S. Watton knew it was out there, too. He wanted to figure out what it was. Bad enough to pay me to do it. Things were perking up a bit.